Who is this?
As my associate indiscreetly told you, we don't have names.
You have a listening note?
That's all I could do after you closed the shades. Agent Scully.
You borrowed the Constitution?
Yes. It's what allows foreign terrorists to live here and enjoy the American dream until time comes to destroy it.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. And it's cool today. That's right, on the 12th of February 2016. Time to get your donations in. We used to have a cutoff of the 15th. I think we got to reinstall that because some of them drag their feet a little bit on this stuff. So get your donations in. We've done our part. We put up putting up a new website, refurbished the website, and we're going to have all kinds of good stuff up there. So, and it's going to cost us quite a bit more money too. So anyhow, get it in here, and we'll do the rest. Well, let's go see how Max is doing on the economy here on Freya's Day.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Malcolm X said, usually when people are sad, they just don't do anything. They just cry over their condition. But when they get angry, they bring about change. Are Americans done crying and ready for a change? Stacey, what do you think?
Well, of course, everybody's worried about the rise of Sanders and the rise of Trump and the whole primary system. So, first, we're going to start, however, to where is all of this anger coming from? Why nobody is happy with the U.S. economy. This is from John Authors of the Financial Times. And this is a painfully slow recovery. Employment as a percentage of population age 16 plus. So this is going back to 1948 all the way through to the 80s. And then rising up, the percentage of the population was 64% employed. Now it's sunk down to below 60%. So he's saying it's this, the fact that employment hasn't risen since the crisis began. Unemployment has fallen, of course, but that number we know can be manipulated.
Yeah, that's right. This is a great little chart, isn't it?
It is. I like it.
It shows, is this the same thing as the participation rate?
Yes.
This is the participation rate. It looks pretty shoddy. So going back to 2000 and spend. So that's a precondition for anger.
That's a precondition for anger, because if you're not fully employed and you're not earning money, especially in a place like the United States where you have health care costs and things like that, and student tuition and debts and stuff like that, you're going to be suffering. So people are angry, and they're angry at their condition, so they're backing the likes of Bernie Sanders, who is looking at introducing democratic socialism and getting rid of high tuition fees and getting rid of, well, introducing a Medicare for all. So he was, of course, surging ahead of Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, and Bill Clinton went up there.
Oh,
and
no.
This is one of the most remarkable pieces of chutzpah I ever saw. So if you want to see the definition of chutzpah, here it is. Bill Clinton unleashes critiques of Sanders and his supporters. On Sunday of last week, Clinton further scolded Sanders for being part of the near-unanimous House vote in favor of the 2000 Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Quote, her opponent, a champion of all things small, an enemy of all things big, voted for that bill. But you will never hear her say that he is the tool of Wall Street because of that, Clinton said, neglecting to mention that he was the president who signed that bill into law. They made a mistake, but it did contribute to the failure of Lehman Brothers, he said.
Well, Commodity Futures Modernization Act, of course, reclassified a lot of derivatives trading so that it was no longer under the regulatory authority of gambling. They legitimized a lot of these derivatives trading, which allowed for a lot of the banks to lower their reserve requirements. so that they could engage in even more of these types of speculative gambles. Alan Greenspan also lowered the reserve requirement for banks during that era to make it easier for banks to do all kinds of gambling in the derivatives market or the options and futures market. And Bill Clinton was pressured into this. Robert Rubin,
Alan Greenspan,
Summers.
Larry Summers.
These guys who, by the way, Barack Obama inherited during the crash period of 2008, going back a ways, they're the guys who are the architects of this hyper-financialized American system that is become a black hole of debt. In other words, they have to keep printing money just to keep the derivatives Ponzi scheme going, and now we end up with all that debt now actually cutting into the real economy.
So let's roll that back a bit, because what happened in 1999, 2000, before this Commodity Futures Modernization Act, is Brooksley Bourne, who we covered, she was the head of the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and she was worried about the explosion of these credit default swaps and derivatives, and she thought they should be regulated like futures contracts. And Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and Alan Greenspan ganged up on her. There are notes that were revealed from their lunch meeting where they bullied her and they said, you're crazy. In fact, Alan Greenspan at that time said a little bit of fraud is good for the system. So even if there's a little bit of fraud, the markets will regulate the fraud. And this is his famously during the financial crash, he came out and said, well, he was wrong about his ideology. So because of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, there was an explosion of credit default swaps, of derivatives, mostly betting on U.S. housing, and that resulted in the disaster. Now, you know, this chart that we're going to go back to, that 1999 is the peak of employment percentage, and then it's been crashing since, partly because banks, the economy doesn't need any production of real stuff because they can produce these derivatives, and that can create an infinite amount of perception of economic activity. So we've had the decline. Nobody needs a job because of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, partly.
We went from factories and workers to algorithm traders and speculators. That was a key transition in the economy. A lot of people don't realize, especially those who are in the left-wing political camp or socialist camp, they still talk about labor and factories, not knowing that in the year 2000 there was a paradigm shift toward algorithms and speculators, and that became the means of production. And as the wealth of those who control the means of production, algorithms and speculation, fueled by cheap money, these folks were just no longer required in the economy. You don't need workers. You don't need their taxes. When you can speculate and get bailed out if your bets go wrong, you can leverage to infinite quantities, especially in the UK, with infinite rehypothecation, and the rewards are vacuumed up by the insiders who are acting as plutocrats or kleptocrats or however you want to describe them, just basically Ponzi scheme manipulators.
So, of course, when Bill Clinton went up there to, make this demonstration of chutzpah, he went up there wearing this, like, lumberjack sort of button-up shirt, and he, put on he adapted the role of Bubba. Remember, this is the whole, how he partly won twice the U.S. presidency. He acted like this, exaggerated his whole Arkansas thing, and he was like Bubba, and for the working white class guy, and this brings us to the headline, tied with this Why Nobody is Happy chart, and tied with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. This is a Guardian U.S. Examination of financial despair, addiction, and the rise of suicide in white America. The death rate for white Americans aged 45 to 54 has risen sharply since 1999. But Montana officials wrestle to explain why the state has the highest rate of suicide in the U.S. at nearly twice the national average, and it is rising. Well, Montana, over 89% of the population is white, just 0.6% is black, and in the white American population, suicide and overdose death is soaring, and it's this case in Montana as well. And a Princeton study revealed that the death rate for white Americans aged 45 to 54 has risen sharply since 1999, that key point of 1999. The increase by 20% over the 14 years to 2013 represents about half a million lives cut short. Now, to put it into context, in the UK, for the same age group, the suicide rate has declined by 30% in that same 14-year period of 1999 to 2013.
Black America is resilient. White America is not. And what we've seen here is that over the past couple of decades, with the transition, as I described, in the year 2000 to an algorithm and speculator-based paradigm, the white guys in America, their work is completely unneeded, and they're not resilient because ever since World War II, they've been spoon-fed the American dream on a platter. The riches of the rewards of having been victorious in World War II carried on for decades. And then suddenly the rug was pulled out from underneath this population, and the white population is not resilient, so suicide rates climb.
Well, they look at examine a few factors in this, and the 80% of the suicides were by men who did not have college degrees, so they were more working class. And, of course, it was under Clinton that we passed NAFTA. It was under Clinton that we had the Commodity Futures Trading Act, Modernization Act. And so all of this, the financialization of the economy, the hollowing out of the working class jobs, like manufacturing, has also happened. But they say that growing economic inequality and increasing financial struggles are intertwined with other issues such as health and addiction. Some people living on low incomes hesitate to go to the doctor, even if they have medical insurance, because of the cost of out-of-pocket expenses. Chronic conditions can go untreated and become debilitating. Pain is a driver of alcohol abuse and addiction to opioid painkillers, which in turn is feeding a growing heroin epidemic in the U.S. Stress and mental health issues are sometimes driven by constant worries about money and fear for the future as growing numbers of Americans look into a financial abyss at retirement. So another factor in this, OxyContin and oxycodone, all those sort of opioids which are being prescribed to white Americans, actually doctors are more reluctant to prescribe them to black Americans because they see them as like drug dealers and they might use it for no good and stuff like that. So they point to, in Montana, 82 out of 100 Montanans are on these drugs. So there are 82 prescriptions per 100.
Well, this is why racism in America has been institutionalized, because the power elite do not want the black community and the white community to join forces and rally towards a quite justifiable insurrection at this point against the kleptocratic Wall Street bankosaurs.
So,
and we just have seen, as I said, institutionalized, media-driven, well-financed racism for this very reason.
So tying it back to Bernie Sanders and why anger is resulting in votes for him and people supporting him, in searching for explanations for why the U.S. is alone among developing countries and grappling with a rising death among its middle-aged white population, Kevin Lowney, who is one of the people profiled in Montana, contrasts his situation with a cousin, a fisherman in Ireland, who was injured in a work accident at sea and spent a year in hospital. Quote, he told me it cost him 39 euros. That's all because of the health system they have in Ireland, he said. So this guy, Kevin Lowney, in Montana, has $80,000 in bills that he's stuck with because of his diabetes and long-term health care issues, because the health insurance doesn't cover it all.
Look at a chart of the number of Americans who are giving their U.S. passport back to the government. They are fleeing. They are expatriating. It's gone exponential for this very reason. They no longer get any value for their tax dollar or the time spent over there at Uncle Sam land.
Well, I'll end on a Malcolm X quote, another one, and that is, nobody can give you freedom. Nobody can give you equality or justice or anything. If you're a man, you take it. Or if you're a woman, you take it too.
All right. Well, we can't take any more of this. We got to get going.
No, I just had a fellow contact me today that's wanting to unite a bunch of groups and so forth like that, and I gave him my opinion. But he was saying he wants to move to Montana and set all this up. And so you can see that is not going to be a very good thing to do if the white guys are all committing suicide up there in Montana. So I'm going to get back with him and tell him you better pick another place, you know, like Alaska or something. Anyhow, also he said about, Max said about the blacks and the whites combining to attack the system. Well, as separatists, we can still attack the system. There's no reason why the white working class separatists and the black working class separatists cannot agree to attack the system. So you don't have to live together and marry each other and fornicate with each other to have a relatively common goal, at least for short term, you know. So anyhow, but you're never going to get the average right winger to think about that. Well, he may give it lip service, but he's not going to do anything about it. So I have a history of attempting to work with black separatists over the years, and I was quite serious about it. And of course, my opposition in the, from the right wing will come out and say, oh, Metzger's going to be a race mixer. He's advocating combining with the blacks. Well, it wouldn't be the first time in history two different armies made up of different people decided to cooperate and attack the system or whatever, whoever they were attacking. So think about it. Well, I see that little Kippy doll over there in North Korea has outfoxed us again. He hasn't outfoxed me, but, you know, this brings about the realization I've said for a long time that all the time this Cold War was going on, and even Vietnam War and Korea, all this stuff, the big boys were working back and forth with the communists. Hell yes, big business was always working with the communists back and forth. So anyhow, we got this little Kippy doll over there in North Vietnam, and he made a deal with South Korea to build big manufacturing plants north of the DMZ. And it, those plants employ 50,000 people. Well, the reason you hear about it is because with him shooting off rockets and stuff, South Korea got pissed off and closing down these plants. But that just shows you, if you've got 50,000 North Koreans manufacturing goods north of the DMZ, and then they're shipping them south, and then South Korea is going to ship a good share of that shit over here in the United States. So here the United States government is always whining about those commies up there in North Korea, that little bastard. Yeah, they're dealing with him. Roundabout way, they're dealing with them, like they always have. That's why the Cold War was pretty much of a scam. The more and more I study it, the more and more it becomes a realization it was a scam. And big business was dealing back and forth all the time. And, of course, the military-industrial complex of Russia or the Soviet Union, they liked it. All the generals were sitting high, and all the generals over here in the Pentagon, they were doing great, and manufacturing all these weapons, and a lot of blue-collar guys, oh, this is great, man. We're making fragmental bombs and so forth there that we can drop on people, but what do we care as long as I can buy me a new car every few years, you know? Just like the so-called winning the Second World War by blowing the shit out of Europe and a lot of other places, sort of built the middle class in this country, and we've been coasting on that war profiting for a long time, but it's run out. It's gone. They used to say, well, it's just because we work hard. Well, yeah, we did work hard in the war plants, building weapons and all that kind of stuff. It's all a scam, boys. It's all a scam. Do you hear any of these Republican candidates or even Democrats talking about lowering the war budget? You know, the war budget this last year was $700 or $800 billion at least, and that's the stuff that we can see on the surface. Doesn't count the stuff that you don't see and all the stuff we're giving to Israel and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Not one of them. They're all crying about the economy, crying, oh, it's horrible, it's horrible, it's horrible. But none of them are saying, well, let's cut the war budget in half and put that money into the highways and schools and everything else and the trains and all that stuff. No, you don't hear any of them. Not one of those fuckers talking about dropping the war budget. If you get around one of them, ask them, say, hey, you asshole, how about if we're so hard up and we're so in debt, why not cut the military budget in half, at least in half? Well, there's a new book out by Anthony Beaver, author of the acclaimed new book about the fall of Berlin on a massive war crime committed by the victorious Red Army. I'm going to read a little bit of this. Red Army soldiers don't believe in individual liaisons with German women. Just a minute here. Wrote the playwright Zakhar Agrinenko in his diary when serving as an officer of Marine Infantry in East Prussia. Quote, 9, 10, 12 men at a time, they raped them on a collective basis. The Soviet armies advanced into East Prussia in January 1945 in huge, long columns, were an extraordinary mixture of modern and medieval. Tank troops in padded black helmets, Cossack cavalrymen on shaggy mounts with loot strapped to the saddle, Lend-Lease Studebakers and Dodges towing light field guns, and then second echelon in horse-drawn carts. The variety of character among the soldiers was almost as great as that among the military equipment. There were freebooters who drank and raped quite shamelessly. There were idealistic, austere communists and members of the intelligentsia appalled by such behavior. Beria and Stalin back in Moscow knew perfectly well what was going on from a number of detailed reports. One stated that many Germans declared that all German women in East Prussia who stayed behind were raped by Red Army soldiers. Numerous examples of gang rape were given, girls under 18 and old women included. Marshal Rokossovsky issued order number 006 in an attempt to direct the feelings of hatred at fighting the enemy on the battlefield. It appears to have had little effect. There were also few arbitrary attempts to exert authority. The commander of one rifle division is said to have personally shot a lieutenant who was lining up a group of his men before a German woman spread eagle on the ground. But either officers were involved themselves or lack of discipline made it too dangerous to restore order over drunken soldiers armed with submachine guns. Now I'm going to send you another part of this book by email, and then you might want to pick up the book because I've read a lot of this stuff, similar stuff before. There's been other books written about this. I understood, though, that there were a lot of Mongoloids that were put in the forces that came into Berlin. I read one account where they didn't even know where they were at, and they were responsible for a hell of a lot of the problem. Of course, you got to remember now, this was the Russian people had lost 20 million. 20 million. It's hard to imagine that amount of people being killed. And Uncle Adolf did attack Russia, surprise attack on Russia. Well, that doesn't excuse the barbarity and wholesale rape and so forth. But on the other hand, you can understand that these people are coming back at the Germans and they're not going to be nice guys. I mean, you know, if that happened here, what do you think would happen? I know what would happen. I know how a lot of the right wing thinks, even the right wing racialist. Everything we do is okay and everything the other guy does is bad. Well, I see the Catholic churches are getting a little worried. Yeah. The Pope is traveling down to Cuba to meet with the Eastern Orthodox, I believe it is. Which leads to me to believe that the Catholic Church is getting a little nervous about the Islam. And behind the scenes, I think they're sort of preparing for a battle. Just my opinion. Maybe just an ideological battle, I don't know.
Christian apologists are very fond of their courtroom dramas, in which carefully chosen experts, under cross-examination, confirm the whole nine yards of Christian doctrine. Of course, the experts happen to be Christians, but that's by the by. Well, I'm going to offer you a courtroom drama of my own today, and this time we are going to put Christianity on trial. So what are the charges? The first charge is that Christianity is an organised protection racket, which exploits popular fears and uncertainties for its own purposes. Christianity invents a bogus problem, that we are all sinners against God's laws, and then offers itself and its invented God-man Jesus as the only solution. By this means, Christianity draws into its clutches millions of gullible victims. The second charge is that Christianity is an organized criminal organization that has plundered the world's riches for 1500 years, accumulating vast wealth and income, and that in the pursuit of this goal, it has waged aggressive wars of conquest, enslaved whole nations, and along the way exterminated millions of innocent people who resisted its designs. The third charge is that Christianity has willfully obstructed human progress and condemned humanity to centuries of poverty, misery, and suffering. In particular, it has obstructed the advance of human knowledge and scientific understanding of the world, including, of course, science itself. A fourth charge is that Christianity has abused and victimized its captives on a monumental scale, its priests and henchmen acting at will and under the protection of the hierarchy of the church, a self-perpetuating and self-protecting empire of physical and sexual abuse. No defense can be mounted against crimes of such horrendous and universal nature. But pleas of mitigation can be made. Christians can claim it was not me. Christians can claim their doctrines give hope to the desperate and consolation to the lonely. But how much false and empty hope can justify wars of annihilation? How much touchy-feely comfort would it require to mitigate the centuries of tyranny and exploitation? The short answer is not nearly enough. Christianity is not only a deceit, a lie, and a scam. It is a crime against humanity, and it belongs in the garbage bin of history with the rest of the rubbish.
And don't forget Judaism and Islam while you're at it. I want to remind you of this deadly effect of uranium, depleted uranium on the soldiers. And thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of civilians in the Middle East. The use of depleted uranium in munitions and weaponry is likely to come under intense scrutiny now that new research has found that uranium can bind to human DNA. The finding will likely have far-reaching implications for returned soldiers, civilians living in what were once war zones, and people who might live near uranium mines or processing facilities. Uranium, when manifested as a radioactive metal, has profound and debilitating effects on human DNA. These radioactive effects have been well understood for decades, but there has been considerable debate and little agreement concerning the possible health risks associated with low-grade uranium ore or yellowcake, and depleted uranium that they're putting in all the weapons, ammunition. Now, however, the Northern Arizona University biochemist Diane Stearns has established that when cells are exposed to uranium, the uranium binds to the DNA and the cells acquire mutations, triggering a whole slew of protein replication errors, some of which can lead to various cancers. Stearns' research, published in the journals of Mutagenesis and Molecular Carcinogenesis, confirms that many have suspected for some time that uranium could damage DNA as a heavy metal independently of its radioactive properties. Essentially, if you get heavy metal stuck on DNA, you can get a mutation, unquote, Stearns explained. While other heavy metals are known to bind to DNA, Stearns and her team were the first to identify this characteristic with uranium. So there you go. Depleted uranium, what is left over when the highly radioactive isotopes of uranium are removed, is widely used by the military. Anti-tank weapons, tank armor, and ammunition rounds are just some of those applications. Quote, the health effects of uranium really haven't been studied since the Manhattan Project, the development of the atomic bomb in the early 40s. But now there is more interest in the health effects of depleted uranium. People are asking questions now, Stern said. Her research may shed light on the possible connection between exposure to depleted uranium and Gulf War syndrome, or to increased cancers and birth defects in the Middle East and the Balkans. And closer to home, questions continue to be asked about environmental exposure to uranium from mine trailings or tailings, heavily concentrated around the native Indian Mongol communities. Quote, when the uranium mining boom crashed in the 80s, there wasn't much cleanup, unquote, Stern said. Estimates put the number of abandoned mines on the Navajo Nation in Arizona at more than 1,100. How about that? I tried my damnedest to get this across to the American Legion people here in this town where I live, and they wouldn't even hear it. They wouldn't even play the tape recording of the findings of this depleted uranium to their members. So I resigned. And it still is not being talked about that much. And there's GIs coming back, and they're having all kinds of problems, and most of them, they don't understand what it is, and they're not getting any help much from the VA. And every once in a while, you'll read where some veteran of the Middle East goes crazy and kills his whole family or something like that. But still, they're not doing anything about it. I also sent letters to the Veterans Administration in Washington with the same kind of no reply that I got locally, so I guess it doesn't pay to be concerned. But I know that they're having tremendous amount of birth defects in Fallujah over there in Iraq, where they really hit it hard with the weaponry. Kids with crazy things, you know, maybe 2 heads or 5 feet or whatever. They're having all that over there now, but they're keeping it pretty quiet. Now, all this stuff is going to be affecting the Middle East for hundreds of years. Now, I don't know whether the Russians are using depleted uranium in their equipment or not, but they probably are. If anybody knows about that or could find out about it, let me know. This is a speech by Kai Moros that took place back in 2010 in Moscow. Dark clouds are hanging over Europe. Well, they're a lot darker now in 2016. The European people have been utterly betrayed by their elite. The magnitude of this conspiracy is unprecedented in human history. Our ruling elite has turned out to be a mere corrupt lackey of global capitalism. These high-priced parasites have stolen the Europeans their livelihood, their land, their future, and their self-esteem. These prostitutes of the corporate world have also exposed Europe to an endless rampage of brutal beggars and forcefully denied Europeans any means of defending themselves. We've become powerless. We have lost control of our lives. We are denied our place in this world, and our spirit is waning. What once was ours has been taken away and given to greedy aliens. What we once held sacred is ridiculed and mocked by arrogant intruders. What once was familiar to us has now been degenerated into something strange and threatening. For decades, Europeans have been taught to hate and despise themselves. Generations of Europeans have been brought up believing that the world would be a better place without them. They have been brought up to feel that the crushing weight of the white man's endless guilt. Europeans are constantly reminded that only through self-destruction can they pay for the sins of their civilization. Let's see here. The death of Europe is the fashion of the day. Our demise is a sign of progress. The disintegration of traditional Europe, a way forward. The predatory invasions against Europe, only the latest trend, self-hatred, a sure sign of intellectual thinking. We are called to celebrate the physical and intellectual, cultural and spiritual collapse of our civilization. We have already been brainwashed to believe that the collapse is inevitable and that it is a law of nature that we should die out and the barbarian hordes at our gate should win. Under the disguise of liberalism, humanism, and democracy, Europeans have been persuaded to commit an ethnic suicide. A race that has achieved so much and has survived so much has been tricked to become its own downfall and to take active measures in order to become a stranger on its own soil. We are witnessing the most vicious and cruel conspiracy in history, the conspiracy to replace the European people, a systematic campaign to wipe out the Europeans from the existence, first by socially degenerating the people, and then through mental and physical retardation to paralyze the ability of the people to resist, to poison the very biological stock where all the great deeds of the past once grew, so that in the end a herd of geldings would be easier to usher to their death rather than the once proud race of warriors, craftsmen, and explorers. But as our situation deteriorates, the harsh, deep realities of life will force the European people to open their eyes. Undoubtedly, the media will try to deny the truth until the end, and the academic elite will keep on spreading lies as it has always done. But once we hit rock bottom and face doom, the truth will come out. They may preach leftism, liberalism, feminism, love, peace, reason, tolerance, but as our desperation and anger grows, the old instincts start working again. We are biological beings, after all, and we have the will to survive. The need to protect our offspring and to urge to defend our territory still intact. They cannot erase them from our genetic makeup. You can fight nature only so far, but once you have crossed the line, nature strikes back. This is a struggle between sterile theories and the primitive force within us, between high-flying political correct ideals and our atavistic passions, and in the end, life will prevail over theory and abstractions. The war for liberation of Europe, and hopefully the United States, means that in the future, global politics will be dictated by our biological needs and instincts. the collective beast of Europeans will take over and replace the soft, polite, liberal, and civilized superego. It is clear that when the beast takes over reason, tolerance and moderation must step aside. The European Revolution will be the revolution of the subconscious. The modern world has turned into a deadly trap to us, and in order to break free, we will turn to the dark side of our personality for strength. Many of you may ask, will it be too late? Maybe the aliens are already too strong when Europeans finally awake. How can we beat them if we are already in the minority? We will win against the intruders because our resolve is stronger. We are defending our own soil, and our own roots go deep. We will win because our existence is at stake. Our strategic advantage in this struggle is that we have no place to go. Once we realize that we are cornered like rats, we will unleash a frenzied attack. The war for the liberation of Europe will be the climax of our history. Because of this war, everything that has happened to us so far makes sense. Our history is a gradual development so that in the end we would declare this war. This war is the logical conclusion of our past and a direct consequence of what has been done to us. The powers that can be can only blame themselves. This war is also the beginning of our future, something we will create together as one powerful nation. After we have dealt with our enemies, there is no limits to what we can achieve and how far we can reach. We must in the end admit that we actually need this crisis. This crisis will bring out the best in us. It will harden us, make us strong and wise. Without this crisis, there would not be unity among Europeans. Only the sense of imminent death will bring Europeans together. Only the looming peril will force the Europeans to find each other as brothers and sisters, and only the burning hatred towards a common enemy will help Europeans to erase all national barriers dividing and weakening our race. The war for the liberation of Europe will finally weld us as Europeans together. It had to be this way. Economy, technology, and some artificial political ideals were never enough to create a nation. The liberal fantasy was doomed right from the start. Instead, we need this intense pressure from the outside. We need this struggle over life and death. We need this explosion of shared emotions, fear, hatred, rage, love, loyalty, courage. In the end, blood is united with blood, and we will witness the birth of a nation. The common struggle, the tears of loss and the tears of joy, the memories of those who return home and the memories of those who die in battle will create the mists that bind us, Europeans, together until the end of days. This war will erase our troubled past and give us a future. We absolutely and categorically need this war. We need one more war, a war of all wars. One magnificent, glorious, noble, mesmerizing, enticing, breathtaking war. We must never be ashamed to admit that the resurrection of Europe requires the greatest war this planet has ever seen. As long as the Europeans were on top of the food chain, running their colonial empires across the globe, we didn't have to worry about the survival of our race and civilization. Europeans were only concerned about fighting other Europeans and becoming more powerful at the expense of their racial kinfolk. But now we have lost the colonial empires and we are about to lose everything else as well. Under the pressure, we will, however, adapt, learn, and evolve, and as a result, we will become more cunning, cruel, ferocious. This crisis teaches us to win. This crisis forces us to win. Today, the media claims that Europeans are sterile, aging, and tired. The Europeans are peace-loving. The Europeans are shy, weak, and always willing to step aside. The Europeans are too tired to build anything anymore, too lazy to produce anything anymore, that Europeans have lost their lust for life. We will show them. Let the whole world know that the Europeans refuse to die. Let it be clear to everyone on this planet that Europeans will not apologize and will not retreat anymore. We will go further than ever before. We conquer the future for us, and we will not share it with anyone. What Europe needs, she takes. For us Europeans, defeat is not an option. We have created the greatest civilization on Earth. We have always crushed our enemies. We have explored the planet, reached the moon, split the atom, and accumulated scientific knowledge far more than any other of the races together. Even today, at the moment of our weakness, we are still admired and envied by the entire world. Our enemies, the vile alien masses herding in our street, attacking, extorting, robbing our people, abusing our hospitality, laying claim to our soil, have not yet even grasped what absolute and total violence in massive scale means. They seem to think that they can intimidate us into submission by using terrorism and petty gang violence. But they forget that once us Europeans turn violent, we wipe out races. We destroy entire civilizations. We desolate continents. And we start world wars. Europeans are masters of violence. The nature has endowed us with courage, patience, resilience, and a systematic mind. We will use these gifts to the fullest in coming years. We will declare a total and radical war of destruction on those who wish us harm, and we will not stop until we have destroyed them completely. Those who hope that Europe will fall will soon be greatly disappointed, and those who conspire to harm Europe and Europeans will soon fear for their lives. There's no place on this earth where they can hide from us. We will hunt them down, and we will make them pay. The liberals keep warning people about us and our plans. The liberals are like old babbling women who tell horror stories of what will happen if nationalists take over one day. And of course, the liberals are right. Once we are unleashed, we will open the gates of hell and summon the furor of Europeans. There is nothing more frightening in this world than the bloodlust of a nation that has suffered injustice. We accept the fact that there is a struggle in nature and that all biological as well as cultural evolution is based on this constant struggle. We maintain that the highest form of social and cultural struggle is the struggle between entire civilizations. The age of competing nations is over as nations are now regrouping and gathering under the banners of civilization. Civilizations are superorganisms. They compete over living space and resources, and only the strongest will prevail. We maintain that European civilization is superior to all other civilizations, and that all her needs must be met first. In order to protect her interests globally, we will call a global mobilization of the European people. For us, there is only one law, the highest law, one survival. And whatever course of action we may choose in the future, its sole purpose is the implementation of this law. The coming war is not going to be a moral problem. The coming war will be a mere technical problem. And once we've solved the technical problem, we will be able to wage a war of absolute destruction in all corners of the earth as we see fit. We can take the initiative wherever, whenever, and against whomever we want, and stay on the offensive until the enemy is exterminated. For us, war is the logical culmination of evolution. For us, politics is secondary to war. For us, politics is just a prelude to war. All the great questions of our time can and will be solved through war. The world is facing cataclysmic changes as the tectonic plates of races and civilizations are colliding. Overpopulating is making the world too small for us all. The endless minor conflicts that have burned across the planet for decades will grow into gigantic genocidal wars over living space and life-sustaining sources. Water, food, breathable air, and energy. Societies will fall, chaos will reign, and civilization will collapse, leaving most parts of the planet into savagery. Europe will face these challenges in the future by systematically waging wars with radical environmental, ecological, and ethnic goals. We will check the avalanche of hostile over the growing populations. We will decimate the predatory migrations against Europe. All threats against Europe will be eradicated. We will strike overpopulation right at its source. What starts in the streets of Europe with fists, knives, broken bottles will end in gigantic clashes in faraway battlefields. Our front line stretches from the Strait of Gibraltar to Vladivostok and from the Rio Grande to the shores of Australia. In these wars of tomorrow, there will be no Finns, Russians, Swedes, or Spaniards, Italians, or Irish anymore, because such concepts have simply ceased to exist. The warriors of the future are simply Europeans united in common struggle, sharing the baptism of fire and communion of power. In the crucible of these cataclysmic wars, an entirely new race is born. Through pain and struggle, new European man will reclaim his throne, sacrificing himself at the altar of his race. The new European man will be bestowed upon unforeseen powers. We will wage the coming wars with religious devotion. Europe's future armies will be a new holy order in a modern battlefield. For them, the destruction of Europe's enemies is a sacred ritual. Our fanaticism and uncompromising radicalism will be a rude awakening for those who thought that we would happily accept defeat. In order to secure Europe's place in the world and to restore her power and prestige, we must resort to total mobilization of Europe's productive forces. Europe must stand on its own again. Europe must be self-sufficient. All ties of dependency to foreign production must be cut. Europe must be able to produce everything her people, economy, and armed forces need. Our grand strategy must be absolutely clear to absolutely everybody, right from the start. 1, we will reindustrialize Europe. 2, we will remilitarize Europe. 3, we will revitalize Europe. This gigantic undertaking will restore the pride and self-esteem of the European working class and a future for those millions of Europeans whose lives have been shattered by the blinding forces of global capitalism. This unprecedented collective effort in European history will guarantee that no European will ever again be without a proper job with a proper wage, that no European will ever again go hungry, and that there will always be a decent home for each and every European. Once again, everyone is important, as all hands are needed in the reconstruction of Europe. We will snatch Europe from the jaws of death and make her queen of continents again. All this, much and much more, we will do so Europe will live forever. In the years to come, our movement will evoke ancient forces, restore long-lost traditions, find what once was lost, and mend what once was broken. Stories will be told and songs will be sung, telling of the deeds of the heroes who fought today for the survival of Europe. And finally, when all is done and the heroes have receded into the twilight of the gods, we can safely say that the prehistory of our race is over and the future just about to begin. I think that was a great speech to end the week on, and I'm going to be back with you on Moonsday. And think about that speech. That covers it all. That gets us out of all this religious crap and all this other stuff, but back into evolutionary barbarity. We forget their politics, their stupid politics, political parties, and all the nonsense. And let's get at it. Start building.
You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.